tables if council for LS versus CLGB would take their places. Ready, sir?
I am.
All right. If you would please proceed. Thank you.
Please, the court. I'm Joe Silver, appearing on behalf of C.B. Richard Ellis. Your Honors, this second matter on your docket likewise concerns matters of subjective versus objective interpretation. It was Judge Hoffman below who said in the determination that permeated both Section 105 and 106 in the constructive fraud contexts that the members of CLGP had simply never intended to make the LLC insolvent, but made a mistake in the amount that they set aside. He said that in the end, they, in reference to C.B. Richard Ellis, hit a home run in expensive arbitration, and they're left with a company that has no assets. But in the end, I have to say, I believed Mr. Hatch. I believed Mr. Student. I don't think they had any intentions of defrauding or hindering the plaintiff. Judge Hoffman said, this gets, though, back to the reasonableness of the reserve, but I believe Mr. Student when he testified that he expected this case to settle. I believed when he thought that was going to settle. The subjective application, the subjective observation by the lower court is error in the construction and application of CUFTA, because constructive fraud, both under 105 and 106, has an objective application such that the intention of the transferee is inapplicable. Rather, we look in determining objectively whether there was an intention to hinder, delay a creditor's right, whether the circumstances of the actions gave rise to that hindrance.
Mr. Silver, can I ask you and get you into the objective framework? And let me start with a couple of premises. One, I think the district court ultimately gave you both of them. Well, number one, he was sympathetic to your plight. Didn't get you anywhere, but you got his sympathy. Number two, I think ultimately he found there was no reasonably equivalent value, so he got you the threshold under, I think ultimately did, and let's say we give you that. Tell me under 106, insolvency is a test, it's a snapshot at the time of the transfer. And at the time of the transfer, as I understand it, they had a debt at that snapshot picture in time of $177,000, and they reserved $200,000, maybe in an odd way, but they reserved it. Tell me how, on that snapshot moment in time, objectively, apart from what the district court found or didn't find, they were rendered insolvent.
A couple of components to the response. First of all, in CUFTA, it is not quite the snapshot that the Title VII suggests under the Limited Liability Corporate Act. It's not just the snapshot. Because what we have under the bankruptcy code in CUFTA is interpretive law that talks about insolvency in two alternative ways. If the sum of the debtor's debts is greater than all of the assets, or if the debtor is generally not paying his debts as they come due. And what the In re Mussa case held, which is cited, is that in this context, we don't have just that instant of a snapshot, but courts have interpreted the language of the Uniform Act to speaking in terms of a series of transactions and something broader than simply a snapshot in that instance. But at that time, the second component of my answer to your query is, at that time, there was a $177,000 commission, 12% interest, attorney's fees to boot, arguably something more than the $200,000.
I'm confused by that. At that time, I don't see there was any of that. At the time of closing.
At the time of closing, coincident with a determination not to pay the commission, there was a contingent liability that an adverse determination would yield the sum of those things. So I don't want to pass the point that the liability to boot was significantly, potentially, larger than that amount. So we have a couple of things. Number one, we have generally a finding by the lower court that there was an insolvency. Judge Hoffman said they probably were insolvent in a bankruptcy context.
Do you think that was, with in context, was talking about after the fact with the benefit of hindsight? I know the language was not precise, but I guess we review.
I'm going to take both. I'm going to take, yes, it was, with the benefit of what he understood, and perhaps it was more than broader than the snapshot Your Honor is focusing on. But if that's an issue that's both factual and legal, he found that insolvency, notwithstanding his rejection of the expert proffered him to opine, he made that reference in the context of what evidence was, and Your Honors are able to consider the construction of the statute in arriving at whether there was either under 105 an unreasonably small amount left, or under 106 whether there was insolvency at the time. And I would suggest that the unsecured, unsigned, not papered promise by the members of CLGP to pay prospectively a capped sum after having depleted the entirety of the in excess of $2 million of proceeds is an unreasonably too small amount and suggestive of solvency for these reasons. Number one, the entity was out of business. The single-purpose entity, whose only purpose was to acquire and dispose of this property for profit, had accomplished its end. So there was no income generation. Number two, in construing CUFTA, Your Honors have Section 104 before you, which says that in an area of law not distinct from other areas, consideration doesn't suffice. Value is actual monies held or paid. So under 104, the promise to pay, the member's promise to pay, the capped amount of $200,000 to pay was valueless. There was no value. That's what 104 says. It says it's akin to those areas in the law where akin to an objective or objective standard, consideration, the promise to pay isn't sufficient. In Article 3 of Title 4 in the UCC, when we talk about creating holder in due course status, if I'm going to pay in order to become a holder in due course, my promise to pay for that note isn't sufficient. The law requires that value be given. CUFTA is the same legislative framework. 104 says that there is no value to be ascribed to a promise to pay. And what these members did is they conditioned the closing on a title company's concurrence that they wire the monies directly to them, 100% of the proceeds, in violation of their operating agreement, which expressly provided that the members were entitled to no money unless and until creditors were paid. They weren't entitled to any, all or any portion of their amount, of their contribution or proceeds, unless and until all creditors were paid. So in violation of their operating agreement, with an understanding that the closing agent, the title company, will not escrow monies, not pay attention to any demand by the broker, and wire the entirety of the monies outside of the framework of the LLC, but directly to the members for their use. The entity had nothing left but the special members.
Yes. Before we completely leave the insolvency question, I'd like to ask you something, if I may, please.
Yes.
Do we really understand what the trial court meant by using the word insolvency? I understand that you're saying we've got a clear winner here, but do we really know what the trial court meant? And did the trial court make sufficient findings to justify us saying, yeah, you've got a winner here, or do we have to remand to the trial court for further findings so we can understand what it meant when it used the word insolvency?
Well, I think your honors need not remand, because I think the matter of insolvency is an issue is an issue which takes no expert opinion, which is a matter that's defined by statute. And though there is obviously a factual predicate, there's a factual finding of sorts that needs to be made. The definition in the statute is so clear as to enable your honors to determine that in the analysis of whether a debtor is generally not paying his debts as they come due, or whether the sum of its debts exceed the assets, or if I may just for argument's sake, likewise include 105.1b1 that says unreasonably small, because it's the same analysis. What your honors have are undisputed facts which stand for a proposition that at the time of the closing, at which time 2,306,000, all of the proceeds of the sale of the only asset of the entity, were dispersed outside, beyond the entity, to the individuals, leaving the entity nothing but debts, contingent and otherwise.
And that's the argument I understood you making before Judge Bernard's question. I didn't understand you challenged that. They reserved $200,000, not in a way that you think is above board, but I didn't understand you'd be challenging that they had no assets. They had a $200,000 asset, did they not?
No.
No, they had zero at the time, you're saying?
Well, they had, we will take, and what we argued below was anything. I don't mean to be so cavalier in that, but what we said below, you know, the judge asked us directly. They could have put in $200,000, left it in cash in the LLC, and the same thing would have happened, and your clients would have been in the same position. It's the amount that was held in reserve, not the form of the reserve. Is that right? Is that right? And the answer is, it's all of the above.
I didn't see that renewed. I understand you made that below. I didn't see that renewed in the appellate brief.
Well, Your Honor, it's in regards to the request that you interpret the statute. It's in regards to the interpretation. It's the serving up of CUFTA as a matter of law that Your Honors are obliged and able.
I understand that, but if you're saying that they were insolvent, my question is, are they insolvent because they had zero, or they're insolvent because they had $200,000?
They're insolvent on any analysis, which is my cavalier response. Yeah.
And if they're insolvent on $200,000, what amount would not render them insolvent?
An amount which, in considering all of the circumstances, would show that they would have had the ability to pay their debt.
Give me an amount, though. What at the time of the closing, what would you, if you were advising them and say, I want to avoid a CUFTA argument arguably defraud a creditor?
There was testimony before Judge Hoffman, which, though he disregarded it, he wound up at the same place.
And she said how much?
Appropriate discounting. It was appropriate discounting. This
did she give a number?
This accountant actually gave three numbers, and one number was to suggest that this was an equity negative concept, that the suggestion that you take away money altogether and leave nothing zeros it out, so this amount of money is clearly not.
So that's, I get your argument. If there's zero, it's just something. Give me a number that she would say that the argument, if it's 200 is not good enough, what's good enough?
She did not give a number because she was confronted with the facts that were the number, and that's why. But what the burden is not on the creditor to determine what number was adequate. The burden is on the debtor to establish, so as to avoid CUFTA.
Isn't it your burden to show is unreasonably small?
Of course it is. But I'm talking in terms of the experience, in terms of the facts that unfold at the time. What would have been sufficient is not to violate the operating agreement, not to depart from their practices of dispersing in violation of the agreement and providing an amount. And you know what? An amount of money that could have been in the picture reasonable might have been not something so disparate from $200,000, provided the totality of the circumstances were different. And what Judge Hoffman found was an insolvency with the statute in front of him and presumably not to be disturbed absent clear error. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, Daryl Waz, registration number 10,003, appearing on behalf of the appellants.
Mr. Waz, before you get started, would you stop the clock, please? I think that we will probably give both counsel another 3 minutes, and so we'll give you 3 minutes rebuttal, but we will add 3 minutes to your time, Mr. Waz, all right? Thank you.
I think it's worth noting at the beginning what the procedural context was that confronted Judge Hoffman below. This was not a trial that was held after a complaint was filed, an answer, disclosures, and discovery. This was a traverse of a garnishment, which is a procedural shortcut to addressing issues. Did somebody receive an improper distribution? What was the state of a company at a specific point in time under Section 106? This was an expedited proceeding, and that was the procedure chosen by the appellant to try these issues in the traverse of a garnishment. One of the things they alleged in the traverse of the garnishment, which is a verified pleading, verified by counsel in this case, but verified nonetheless, was that at the relevant date, as of April 2nd, 2007, the date of the closing, there was a $200,000 reserve owned by the company, reserved by the company. So Mr. Silver stands here today. They didn't appeal this issue, but in their own pleadings, they alleged this asset existed. There's no dispute about whether the asset existed. They alleged it. They proved it. We proved it. The judge found it. That's an issue that was clearly found. So what Judge Hoffman had before him, and after a long day of testimony that went deeply into the evening and he ruled from the bench, was a set of facts that had been developed through the day with no record, surprise witnesses, the expert who appeared on the solvency issue, which is the only evidence presented by the appellant on solvency, was an expert witness who did a pro forma balance sheet that purported to show insolvency in three different ways. Judge Hoffman and the other parties cross-examined this witness at length, and the judge ultimately found she pulled the numbers out of the air. I simply didn't believe her testimony. I wanted to hear some testimony about how this company was insolvent as of the relevant date. Why is it relevant? Because the statutory section that they're really relying on today is 106, and we have an issue about whether they appropriately preserve that for appeal. They didn't argue it at the hearing. The judge hadn't heard an argument about that before he made his ruling, but he did hear arguments about solvency under 106 that requires the finding of insolvency at that time. Those are critical words in that statute, and the time it refers to in this case is April 2nd of 2007.
I may interrupt for a moment. The judge, both in his oral ruling from the bench and in his written ruling, makes references to insolvency. For example, in his written ruling, he writes that even if defendant was rendered insolvent in the bankruptcy sense by the distributions, which it seems to have been, how can we figure out what this reference to insolvency means? And then once we figure it out, what should we do with that?
I think you have to start with what it is he could not have found. And on the record he had, it's inconceivable that he could have found that the company was insolvent as of April 2nd, 2007. All the evidence he had was it had one asset, $200,000, not disputed. It had one liability.
Oh, maybe disputed.
Well, it's not really. I mean, they alleged it under oath, their oath. They didn't dispute it at trial. Their complaint at trial was really, you saved this asset. That was for us. Why didn't you spend it on us? They abandoned that theory. Part of the problem the trial court has was there were six legal theories at the beginning of the day. There were four at the end of the day. There are two today. So a lot of this evidence goes back and forth. But what the judge, so you have to look first, what were the facts Judge Hoffman, who is not an inexperienced insolvency lawyer, you can read his findings, you can see he understands these concepts. What did he have before him? He had one asset, one liability, period. That's what he found, and he found that's not insolvency.
Mr. Wuz, did the court make a dollar amount of what the liability was? Did you make a finding?
He said the maximum, I don't know if he didn't say in his findings the maximum liability was $177,000, but he found they were solvent as of that date. Where did he find it? Page 2 on his order on the motion to reconsider. He said, and I quote, that he found that the reserve, the $200,000 that was established, was sufficient to keep it solvent. It has to be CGLP, and the solvency has to be as of that date. That's where he found they were solvent. When this question came up on the motion to reconsider, gee, Judge, you used this word insolvency, he said in his order, I find the reserve was sufficient to keep it solvent.
I'm missing that language on page 2.
It's on page 2.
Because that's the same paragraph I'm reading where he said that even though they seem to have been rendered insolvent in the bankruptcies, it may be there. I'm just missing it.
Yeah, if you look, it's in the first paragraph, Your Honor, and it's about three lines from the end of the first paragraph, and the line begins, debtor would have thought sufficient. In my judgment, any reasonable debtor would have thought sufficient to keep it solvent despite the distributions.
On page 2 of the motion to order the denying reconsideration?
That's correct.
June 10th, 2009?
Yes, and the
or July 22nd of 2009.
It's July 22nd, 2009.
I'm missing. Tell
page
me
two. Well, the paragraph begins on page 2. Let's make sure we got the same page.
I found it was reasonable.
It says, I found that defendant's 200 reserve was reasonable. If you go down to the third line from the bottom of that paragraph.
Oh, from the bottom. Okay.
Third line from the bottom. Defendant did not intend that result precisely because it reserved an amount that, in my judgment, any reasonable debtor would have thought sufficient to keep it solvent.
Okay, so it's three from the bottom. I'm sorry.
Yes.
But then at the same time, he says that even if it was rendered insolvent, and he kind of goes into an intent kind of based analysis.
He talks about the intent phase, and what you have to bear in mind was he's talking about the intent element in his long findings at the end of the hearing. He's talking about the element of actual fraud. And the actual fraud statute in 105A, they have badges of fraud. They say, among other things, the court considered these nine things. One of the things is, was the debtor insolvent at the time of the transfer, or did it become insolvent? That's the element he's talking about when he starts talking about insolvency. And in that context, he said, the defendant reserved an amount that, in my judgment, any reasonable debtor would have found sufficient.
Could have thought sufficient, so he's going on to intent. But you would agree, would you not, that he's mixing a lot of concepts and it's not a model of clarity, any of these orders?
You know what? I don't agree with that because I don't think he was mixing the concepts. I think that the plaintiffs didn't know what theory they wanted to go in with when they started this. They charged breach of the operating agreement. They charged violation of the LLC statute. They charged actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. They charged two different grounds for subjective fraud under CUFTA. And they now say they charged 106. So they come in with six legal theories. At the end of the day, the judge is trying to unwind it. But what he said about insolvency at the end of the day, if you read it carefully, and I'll quote it, he says, they might have proved insolvency in the bankruptcy sense because, so you can explain why he's saying that, because they have ended up not being able to pay their debts. That's on page 373 of his oral findings. That's where he used the word. And then he immediately says, immediately after that, we have to be careful about not putting on our 2020 glasses. The question isn't whether they ended up being unable to pay this debt. The question is whether what they did at the beginning was reasonable. He's talking about the elements of 105 here that deal with whether you reserve sufficient capital. Did you make a fair provision for the payment of debts? That's what he's discussing at that point.
I understand that that's your argument, Mr. Wass, and I also understand that it's your position that they didn't push 106.1 below. But let's assume for purposes of discussion that we conclude that 106 was properly preserved and is in front of us. Aren't we at that point faced with a problem here? I understand that your argument is that the insolvency determination was appropriate at least for 1B2 because that had to do, that affects that intent concern in 1B2. And I understand that. But if he says this is what in fact happened and that it was rendered insolvent, how do we deal with that under 106?
Well, first of all, not to quibble, but he didn't say it was rendered insolvent. He said they might have shown insolvency in the bankruptcy sense.
Which it seems to have been.
Which it seems to have been. And clearly, when you look at his ruling, what he's talking about is they ran out of money. Unexpectedly, nobody should have predicted it at that time, nobody would have predicted it. He says that very clearly. And he didn't say they did. He said they might have. He's talking as he's making this ruling. He didn't go back and prepare written rulings. He's talking. So could you remand and say, could you make this clear? You could. But when the obfuscation, if there's any, is a result of, the appellant did not argue in their closing that there was an issue of insolvency. It didn't come up. They had abandoned this issue. Their expert had testified. The judge had clearly indicated through his questions that he didn't buy any of her testimony, which was the only evidence on insolvency. So they just didn't even argue it. They didn't say in their motion to reconsider to the judge, what about this solvency question under 106? You didn't even decide that. They didn't raise it there, or he could have dispatched it right then. But he did do in his written ruling is he entered a finding of fact, which is entitled to discretion on appeal absent clear error, that there was solvency as of April 2nd, 2007, because you can't logically keep something solvent if it isn't solvent. If he said it was sufficient to keep it solvent, that necessarily is a finding that it was solvent as of the relevant date. And if it was solvent as of the relevant date, there are no theories left here. I mean, that is really the only theory they're pursuing. They have appealed the question of whether there was unreasonably small capital, but that's what the judge clearly disposed of. They say they're appealing the question of whether they incurred or intended to incur debts in excess of the value of the assets reserved. But clearly the judge handled that. He said, here's what they had, here's what they owed, here's the provision they made. He heard the testimony of the witnesses, and he said, I believe those witnesses, that they thought this was sufficient, and I think it was sufficient. Based on my own experience, I think that anybody would have thought that this liability could be disposed of by the asset that was reserved.
Mr. Wass, can I ask you a question, and it may go to the 104B1 unreasonably small prong of the of CUFTA, and it's this, and this is my concern. At the time of closing, their fixed debt or the maximum debt is 177.
That's correct.
And they've reserved $200,000. I'll grant you that. If that's the case, and they decided to pay the 177, then it's fine that they're clearly not insolvent. But if they made the decision that we are not going to pay the 177, we're going to try to hardball this and offer 88 or whatever they offered, and we're not going to pay the 177. Aren't they in a kind of heads we win, tails we lose position that we're going to, our maximum liability is the 200, that's the 177 plus 23. We can eat it all up in attorney fees and fight this and maybe we'll win at the end of the day and we'll keep the remainder. And if we lose it, we're out the 44,000 or whatever small remainder's left, even though we know fighting it, if we make the decision to fight, we're going to be accruing 12% interest and their attorney fees. In addition to our own attorney fees, we're going to be accruing far more than $200,000 at the end of the day. Isn't that, why shouldn't that be a concern?
Well, I think the judge addressed that explicitly in his findings. And he said, if this was a brilliant plan to establish this reserve for the purpose of paying completely unrelated third-party counsel, not me, but lawyers they had to go out and hire, and the AAA, then they decided that they wanted to reserve this money so they could pay money to a law firm and the AAA instead of this creditor. If those were the facts before you, then I think there'd be an issue about whether there was actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors, because that was the point of the transaction. And what the judge found with respect to that argument precisely was that's not what their plan was. And it doesn't make any sense that that would be their plan. They reserved what they thought would work under the circumstances that existed at the time. There was a claim for a commission. There had been discussions about resolving it for less than half the amount that was claimed. There was a pre-existing relationship between the parties. There was sophisticated people involved evaluating what was going to happen. And what happened here, and it's tragic, but it's not completely without any precedent, as the judge observed in his findings, is a case that could have been resolved for $80,000 or $90,000, then simply spun out of control.
But if the agent, the real estate agent, whatever the CGLP or
Mr. Swan.
Okay, CLGP or Ellis, CB Richard Ellis, made the decision, we're entitled to the full amount. We reasonably believe, and it turns out they did reasonably believe, that we're entitled to the full 177. We're not going to settle for 88. Your client made the decision that we're going to hardball this and we're going to not offer the full amount. And if we're going to pay the full amount, it's only going to be after litigation or arbitration. And that's going to cost attorney fees. That's going to render us liable for 12% interest. And it's going to render us liable if we lose for their attorney fees. But at the end of the day, we're not going to have to pay any of that. It's not a subject of actual fraud. I mean, if we're talking about, if you make the decision, you're not going to pay the 177, isn't the 200 by definition unreasonably small?
Well, if there's a point in time where they said we're not going to pay the 177, but the judge made findings on this, it's not what happened. I mean, what happened was a year goes by before one penny comes out of that $200,000. That's intact for over a year. Then an arbitration is filed, and they don't ask for $177,000. They ask for triple damages under the Colorado Consumer Protection Act. They ask for exemplary damages. They ask for tort theories relating to interference with contract. So now there's this huge piece of litigation that's been started. Is it the obligation then of the LLC, in order to avoid any liability for distributions, to simply say, well, then we surrender. If you make a big enough claim and we can see that we could deplete this asset and it might not have been reasonable, now looking back a year and a half when they have this decision to make, look back a year and a half. Those are the 2020 glasses that Jess Hoppin said, I'm not going to put on. And they're the 2020 glasses that the statute doesn't put on. Because if you go down that road, then what you're really saying is any distribution on account of equity is always at risk in perpetuity if any creditor comes back and is disappointed later and has a liquidated claim and there's not money to pay it. And that's simply not what the statute says. And that's contrary to this concept of limited liability. And there are specific statutes that deal with when you can take distributions, what you have to do, when you do to be protected. And that's what the judge was wrestling with below. He did not make clear error. And I don't think it takes a remand to understand what he said. I think he made it very clear in the second order.
Mr. Voss, I do have one question, and this is with regard to the liability, right? You're stating the liability is $177,000. If I understand Mr. Silver, he's saying at the time of closing, it's $177,000 plus 12% interest,
right,
plus attorney fees because of non-payment of the commission, and I wanted to hear your position on that.
My position is that when you look at a statute that says at that time, and when you look at what a balance sheet is, which their own expert agreed to in cross-examination, a balance sheet is a snapshot in time. And the relevant time is April 2nd of 2007. And on April 2nd of 2007, the maximum that liability could have been is $177,000. There was no interest. There were no attorney's fees. There is nothing except $177,000. Their CPA said, but if you multiply that times three based upon now 2020 hindsight, we know that hundreds of thousands of dollars of fees were accrued and interest accrued over years. Now, if you add all that back in and call that the liability, well, then it exceeds the asset. Well, that's true, but there is no legal theory by which you take a liability and increase it in that manner. I mean, in fact, the law, and we cite it in our brief, is that contingent liabilities are discounted. How much? It depends on what the value is of the claim, what's the likelihood of prevailing, how long will it take. But you decrease contingent liabilities, you don't increase them. And that's why her testimony was just rejected by Judge Hoffman and left him with no evidence of insolvency and a balance sheet that showed one asset and one liability and an excess of the asset of the liability. In those circumstances, he couldn't have found insolvency. And a remand only gives him time to state the obvious and sends parties who've been involved in this litigation for an interminable period into it for further. And I ask you not to do that.
Thank you, Your Honors, for the additional time.
Sure.
The language we were speaking to in the findings by Judge Hoffman very quickly, even if defendant was rendered insolvent in the bankruptcy sense, which it seems to have been, defendant did not intend that result precisely because the problem with the judge's ruling there is intention. We're not talking, counsel suggests that this was all mixed up in the context of actual fraud. Actual fraud was not the subject of the motion for reconsideration. Actual fraud had been abandoned by C.B. Richard Ellis at the time it said reconsider your errors in connection with constructive fraud. And it was in that constructive fraud that Judge Hoffman is still relying upon misplaced intention. The Glimcher case is one of many that is cited. The transferee's good faith is irrelevant in a determination of the adequacy under consideration in this act. Transferee's subjective state of mind does not play a role in resolving the present case under CUFTA. The value on the same page that we referenced does not include an unpapered promise made otherwise than in the ordinary course of business. Your Honors, the determination of insolvency by Judge Hoffman was that the entity could not pay its bills. That is a CUFTA definition.
Now, what day was that? What day could they not pay the bills?
Well, it said all we know is from the court's findings, and that it's precisely because it couldn't pay its bills. We don't know.
But a reserve is a reasonable amount.
Your Honor, if a reserve is going to be reasonable, it has to be what's sufficient under the circumstances. The promise unperformed to pay, I would argue, is zero. But even setting that aside, here we have a decision made not only to contest this, but you should understand, as you used the phrase earlier with counsel, the term hardball. The decision was not only to contest this, but the decision was to contest this not by alternative pleadings, but remember that Jesco, one of the members of this LLC, itself sued for a participating commission, even though the arbitrator found that it wasn't licensed at the time it purported to conduct real estate activities. It hadn't disclosed itself as a cooperating broker until after the purchase and sale agreement had been entered into. And the point is that this is not alternative pleading by the defendant that says, we're not liable for the commission, but just in case we are, we're entitled to half of it. These are two separate parties controlled by the same attorneys who's being funded from this reserve, making positions that serve each of their interests, which are separate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silver. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments very much. The case will stand submitted. The opinion will issue in due course. If I could have a